सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। In the last satsang, I will walk through these slides. What we went through, and then we can. I'll quickly summarize what we did in shlokas 1 to 10 by reading through the shlokas and quickly, catching up the key points there, and then we'll continue with 11 to 20. Are you able to see my screen?
Yeah, we can.
So I think in the last session we talked about shlokas 1 to 10, and what we did. Oh, sorry. We have to first go to read the shlokas, chant the shlokas. So I'll try my best. Like I said the last time, I have not read these shlokas in the past, so I will make a lot of mistakes. But please bear with me. And once again, these sentence, these Sanskrit verses here, they are not correct. The words are not correct. So I'm looking at the Gita Press version and reading it. So please ignore if there are mistakes in Manye tvam kalamishanam anadinidhanam vibhum samam charantam sarvatra bhutanam yanmitah kalihi. I believe that you are the time, the great God who does not have any end or beginning, who travels equally in all the beings who appear to differ among themselves. न वेद कश्चित् भगवन् श्रीकृषितं तवेहमानस्य नृणां विडम्बनं नयस्य कश्चित् धियति धियतोऽस्ति कर्हिचित् द्वेष्यश्च यस्मिन् विषमामतिर्नृणाम्। नो वन् अण्डर्स्टाण्ड्स् वाट् इस् इन् योर् मैण्ड् वेन् यु आर् एक्टिङ्ग् लैक् अ ह्यूमन् बीङ्ग्। You are not close or far off from anyone, and it is best who think that you are, and it is people who think that you are biased. Janma karma cha vishvatman ajasya karturatmanaha तिर्यं शिशुयादहसु तदत्यन्तविडम्बनम्। ओ सोल ऑफ द यूनिवर्स, यू आर कंप्लीटली डिवाइड ऑफ बर्थ एंड डेथ। आई थिंक दैट शुड बी डेथ एंड योर बर्थ अमंग स्मॉल क्रीचर्स, मेन, सेजेस एंड एक्वेटिक क्रीचर्स इज योर पास्ट टाइम। गोप्या ददे त्वयि कृतागसिदामतावद् या ते दशाश्रुकलिलाञ्जनसम्भ्रमाक्षं वक्त्रं निनीय भवभावनाया स्थितस् वक्त्रं निनीय भवभावनया स्थितस्य सा मां विमोहयति भीरपि यद्भिभेति। When you broke the pot of curd and offended your foster mother, and she took the rope to tie you, since you were naughty, you stood full of fear, bent face, collyrium flowing due to your tears, and with your eyes rolling in confusion. And this filled me with wonder, because when even fear was afraid of you, how can you be afraid of someone? चिदाहुरजं जातं पुण्यश्लोकस्य कीर्तये यतोह प्रियस्यान् ववाये मलयस्येव चन्दनम्. Some say that though you do not have birth, you are born in the clan of the famous and great Yadu in order to add to his fame, like the sandalwood tree which is born in the Malaya mountains to enhance the glory of the mountain itself. Yado priyasyanvavaye malayasyeva chandanam apare vasudevasya devakyam yachito bhyagat ajastvamasya kshemaya vadaya cha suradvisham. Others say that though you are birthless, you were born to Vasudeva and Devaki as an answer to their prayer and for killing of all the enemies of Devas. Bhara vatarana yanye bhuvo navayivo dadhau sidantya bhuri bharena jato hyatma bhuvarthitaha. Others say that you appeared like a boat in a great sea to take away the burden of them, which appeared sinking as an answer to the prayers of Lord Brahma. Sorry, just hold on a second. I lost my shloka. Bhavesmin klishasyamananam avidya kama karma bihi sravanasmaranan śravana-smaranārhāṇi karishyanniti kechana. Some people tell that you have descended on earth to do the acts fit to be heard or dealt with, even by those who are being tormented in this world of ignorance, desire and selfish acts. Srunvanti gayanti grunantyabhikshyanashah smaranti nandanti tavehitam janah tayeva pashyantya chirena tavakam bhava pravaho paramam padambujam. The people who are partial to you listen, sing, repeat to others and meditate and would alone soon see your lotus-like feet that would end waves of life, of birth and death. And 20th shloka. Appadyanastvam svakrutehita prabho jihasasi svit suhrudo nujivana jivinaha yesham nachanyad bhavatah padambujat parayanam rajasu yojitam asam. O Lord, you always had your interest in mind, and today you are going away from us, and we, your friends, do not have any other protection other than your lotus-like feet, and we have made enemies of other kings by inflicting a lot of suffering on them by this war. So that's 11 to 20. And just to quickly recap what we did in 1 to 10. So the context of Kunti Stuti is that the Mahabharata war is done. And Ashwatthama It's almost done actually, and Ashwatthama is still full of hatred towards Pandavas for whatever reason, and we will not get into those reasons. And so he releases Brahmastra to kill the only child in the womb of Uttara, who is Abhimanyu's wife. And Abhimanyu would have already been slaughtered in Mahabharata war. And then at the time, Uttara runs to Krishna and she prays to him. And then Krishna protects that child, who later on becomes born as Parikshit. And we talked about the relevance of the name Parikshit also, because Parikshit means the guy is always looking at everyone's face after he's born to identify that particular individual who saved him while he was in his mother's womb. And of course, he never finds it till he reads Bhagavatam and he knows who that person is. Once that is done, then Kunti prays to Bhagavan Vishnu, Bhagavan Krishna, about how he has been able to protect the Pandava king, Pandava princess, and all through their journey in the right from the time the Bhima was put into the waters after being drugged, and then they were put into the wax house. And then also all the 13 years what they spent in the forest, and also during the time when they were in incognito, there are a lot of episodes that they talk about it. And now I think in this 11 to 20, she's talking about a couple of things what Krishna does, like what she spoke in the previous shloka also. And of course, it's mixed with respect to both Advaita Jnana as well as Bhakti in both these set of shlokas. So that's the quick and short summary. And I don't intend to go into detail of what we spoke last week, because most of what we spoke was related to how the different leelas of Krishna was and how he protected the Pandavas and everyone. So with that, anyone can quickly share what you learned from these 11 to 20 shlokas, and especially if you can find some connection to Gita, what you have read or heard or listened so far till chapter 8, or even the previous Swami Dayananda book that we completed, we would love to discuss that.
Can I make one comment about verse 10? We were having a discussion about Kunti's request of calamities.
Oh, yeah.
And I just wanted to say to that, perhaps a more modern translation of calamities would be challenges. But regardless, in the Gita, certainly Krishna talks about how whatever happens in life, in our bhakti, we turn to him. And if by turning to him, challenges lead us back, then perhaps they're not so grim. And we all know that in life, often we learn more from our failures than our successes. Certainly entrepreneurs will sing that song. So I just want to say that I don't necessarily, I don't believe it's an error. I believe it's an orientation, and one that I respect. Most of us come to Vedanta not because of joy seeking joy. We come from pain seeking a way out. So I don't find that at all deficient or inappropriate. And I really thought about this. And so those are my thoughts regarding that discussion.
Absolutely, Rick. That's a
Really
very
agree.
beautiful way. Thank you.
Also, the day
There's
before
a
this session, you send out a about what we're going to talk about.
Sorry, say
You
it
do
again.
that the day before you meet on Sunday. Do you
Yeah.
send out something about what we're going to talk about?
Yeah, we normally what we do is after the one satsang is over, we post it in the WhatsApp group. Actually, we probably have not got you on the WhatsApp group. Not sure what your interest is. So,
Can you
if
do
that,
that? Can you do that
yeah,
going forward?
we can do that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Hey,
What about
yeah.
you?
Sorry, Rick. I think Rajesh shared that yesterday, and I forgot to send that to you. So it's
No problem.
my
It
error.
shouldn't be your responsibility. It's just part of the group.
Yeah.
Kishore, you were saying something.
Yeah, Rick, to your point, I completely agree with that. If the again, it's I think it's a matter of perspective. If you see individual challenges and you get buried in it, then obviously it looks daunting at the time. There is no doubt. But if you were to step back, take a longer term view, and if the goal is that of mental purification, then purification can only happen with friction. You can only get the diamond out through friction from stone. So it has to go through friction. There's no other way. So if the goal, then if we are convinced that the goal is mental purification through life, then friction is just part of the game. And you then start to welcome challenges because, you know, the more friction you get, the more purified you're going to get sooner, in fact. So I think it's a matter of perspective, and another way to tide over these challenges when we are faced with them. It's not easy, but it's good to know that there is a different perspective that we can try.
Yeah, and I think just taking the same thread, what you're talking about, right? I think if you look at it, there are two ways of thinking about it, right? One is we're all like those shining diamonds, but covered with that sort of a mud or that's hiding the brilliance from within. And the only way that you can do it is you've got to scrape that mud off, that particular thing. And the mud can't be scraped unless you use some sort of thing to rub it off. And that's why the ignorance in us has to face those challenges in our day-to-day life for us to slowly start chipping it off and start revealing who the true diamond that we are.
The problem though, when you see people going through, suffering or a lot of challenges, be it health challenge, a long-term health challenge, let's just say, or a type of challenge where there's no end in sight, or it's a very long-term kind of challenge that they are going through, then what? It is hard to tell them this, right? It is not easy to, unless they are convinced themselves and this is what it is, right? That it's a type of thing that's going to help them be better on the other side when they reach there. In the sense that it's going to get better as they go through this, rather not on the other side, but as they go through this. But it's hard to tell them that, right? And so I wonder what I'm sure many of us have faced this, where we've seen others go through, or us ourselves and others go through this, and then when the person gets to you saying, "Hey, what do you do?" I wonder how, what do you tell them?
See, the way I understood what Kunti was trying to say is from a perspective that, I think there are two dimensions to it, right? So one is that, she knew that Krishna was the Supreme One, right? And she knew, she was enlightened to that extent that she knew that he was Bhagavan or Brahman, right? At the same time, she starts to say things like, give me problems, because when there are problems, I will be able to then reach out to you and think of you a lot more,
mm-hmm.
right? So I think both of them go in tandem. That is, give me problems so that I can think of you more, which is something like similar to what we hear in the Gita, Tasmat Sarveshu Kaleshu Mam Anusmara. Think of me, and this is an opportunity for me to think of you, because if I have a problem, I have more reasons to actually, so it's a combination of the fact that she knew she was an enlightened one, and she had surrendered to the Lord, and to be able to live in this world and be able to resonate with that continuously, give me problems so that I can think of you and be in constant remembrance of you. I think that's how I've seen it, actually. I mean,
yeah,
actually, that's the way even I've heard it in most cases, and it's the most repeated statement from Kunti Stuti, actually, that give me problems so that I don't forget you.
And the fact that she knew that Krishna was Brahman, right? So a lot of people may have problem.
I'm not sure whether, he's supreme, Whether he's Brahman or not, I'm not sure. She okay. understood. But
okay.
yeah,
I thought the first one was
all-powerful.
All-powerful, supreme personality, whatever, right? So she knew that he was...
He's God.
Yeah, he's God, yeah.
So she knew that he's God. And for her to be able to remember him all the time, she wanted, because that's what had happened whenever they were in trouble. And she knew that, you know, the human tendency is once everything is all right, you forget God is the first thing that goes out, right? So for her to be able to repeatedly remember him is why. And also she was selfish that he will come back if they are in trouble. I mean, that's the connotation I have heard. And very related to devotion. So,
I think in these shlokas 11 to 20, what I found is that there's a lot of similarities to, you know, to the shlokas in Gita, actually.
Chapter 7, yeah.
I don't remember which chapters, but definitely, you know, the first one, which in Shloka 11 today, it says that, you know, you are like time, and who does not, and you are that great person who does not have any end or beginning. That's what it says, right? Manyetvam kala and anadi nidanam vibhum. Okay, that's a beautiful thing. That's a clear indication of, you know, Kunti trying to tell that, okay, you are that personification. You are a principle, but you are personified in that form. And I know that you are the time who are a great leveler. That's a beautiful way. I think even in Gita also, in Vibhuti Yoga, it says, Bhagavan says that I am Kala, which Oppenheimer actually flicked it. And he said, I am death. And did you, one thing which caught my attention is the Shloka 30, where it says that, you are born among different types of species, right? You know, the animals, humans, then also aquatic creatures. I think it sort of indicates that, you know, you could take any form. It does not really matter, and you would be taking multiple forms depending on, you know, what the need of the hour is.
So I think I was just reflecting on Kishore's, you know, good insight around, you know, suffering and remembrance. So is japa, you know, doing japa, like, which is again remembering Ishtadevata name, is that technique to remember God constantly without suffering?
I think so. I think Rick also referred to that in the last satsang that we had.
But again, Kishore's question was also, how do you help direct somebody, or how do you deal with somebody's grief, particularly long term, and be able to give them guidance? But I think this comes back to all of this, as Krishna talks about in the Gita as well, as it is an open secret. It is available. You have to be open to hearing it. And none of us have the ability to make someone else be open. sometimes we struggle to make ourselves open. But again, I think that that's where, like, one of the things interesting I found when Swami Dayananda talked about social workers, he said the mental perspective behind being a social worker is that it's your belief that if you can bring happiness to others, you'll be happy. Well, in the same way, we can only be happy, find true fulfillment in ourselves. And when we do, then we're a light to others. Whether others see the light or not is up to them. And also remember, for all of us, it's very hard to see the light in somebody we think we know. Jesus's comment that no sage is recognized in his own village, in his own family. So even though they're the people closest to us and we care most about, we're often most incapacitated to help them. Anyway, my thoughts.
So one other thing, you know, they're just switching from the pure sort of Vedantic commentary to this, to, you know, bhakti commentary. This in this shloka, you know, I heard Dushyant Sridhar talk about it, 14th shloka, right? So he, you know, this is a beautiful story about Krishna, you know, stealing butter, and then his mother Yashoda trying to, you know, restrain him, and she uses that thread and a rope to tie him around the waist, and that's why he's also called as Damodara. The name that's given to him is Udara is the stomach and Damo is the thread. Okay, so Damodara is that you know, that principal who has the thread tied around his waist, and then he goes on to do some more leelas after that, and you know, that's a beautiful story. And what particularly struck out for me when I read this particular shloka 14 was that, you know, you stood full of fear, bent face, collyrium flowing due to your eyes, due to your tears, and with your eyes rolling in confusion. And this filled me with wonder, because this is what I like the most. Because when even fear was afraid of you, how can you be afraid of something? And that's the beauty of it. Because, you know, I remember I read in one, I don't remember which Upanishad it was, it says very clearly that, you know, I think it was probably Kathopanishad only, where Nachiketa is told, saying that, hey, you know, by Yama, saying that, you know, I do my job because I'm scared. I'm not scared. I'm controlled by Bhagavan to do my job. Just as the sun is controlled, the moon is controlled to do their jobs. Everybody is controlled in by Bhagavan. And we all fear him. And, you know, and that's also personified in the story of Markandeya when death comes and tries to take over Markandeya, and you know, he holds the Shivalinga without letting it go. At that point of time, you know, Shiva comes and protects him, and then you know, he makes Markandeya sort of immortal, who stays across multiple kalpas, and you know, that's sort of indicating that, you know, you are, even fear is afraid of you. But you stood in front of this gopi stri and you were scared. You know, it's all leela for you. You just kind of, you know, do whatever you want to do. It's a very beautiful way of saying bhakti, denoting the bhakti in her story. I liked it, actually. Shri?
Actually, yeah, sorry.
Sorry, go ahead, Subbu.
No. I'm saying, you know, the Lord plays his role very well, right? At some point in time, he sort of wields his Yogamaya energy, and we are all made to think that he's just a human being. And on the other end, he lifts the Govardhan mountain and he kills Kansa and the other demons and you know, starts to show his divinity at some point in time, right? So I think some way that's exactly how sort of some people are not able to accept it, even, you know, with so much of divinity presence, and they see the human facet of it and they get confused. Right. So I think that is something that I picked up from, you know, verse number 14. So this entire thing of this demonstration of divinity is very subtle. Right. And, you know, in 11, 12 and 13, I think there were a few words which I took. So one was, you know, her reference to Krishna as eternal time, which is like eternal witness. So when you say eternal time, you're also saying a person who is, you know, aware of past, present and future, right? So somebody who is, you know, in full control. And then the other adjective used there is supreme controller. And I think there is this verse in Gita which says that not even a blade of grass can move, you know, without his will, right? So that was the other thing. The third thing that came up was some adjectives which I picked up, which she mentions is the Lord is impartial and equal to everyone, yeah? And I think there we understand, you know, how karma theory plays out. And there is some reference there, I thought, in saying that, you know, finally, it's the, you know, Jivatma who's completely responsible for the actions, you know, of good and bad that is there. And God is again an eternal witness, which is what she refers to him as time. And in sloka number 13, there is a reference to Krishna as the vital force, you know, which is probably the consciousness that she's referring here, right? And she says this is something that is pervading everywhere. So some points in the first five verses, and of course, the 14th one is about the role play. I think a fantastic, you know, exhibition of, you know, showing divinity at certain points and at the same time, you know, trying to play the role that he is there for. And when asked this question about why this particular, you know, incarnation, I think that has been answered in Gita as well, you know, right? Yada yada hi dharmasya and pavitranaya sadhunam. I think those two verses relate very much from, you know, verse number 12 of Kunti Stuti. So some reflections on the first five verses here.
Nice. Yeah, can I go ahead?
Yeah.
See, my take on Kunti Shruti is, see, there is no asking for suffering. I feel, you know, samsara itself is suffering. So that is one. Huh? And second, suffering itself is relative, if you ask me. So, suffering for one person could be not a suffering for another person also. So the definition of suffering itself is relative. That is one now. So in fact, I was listening to Swami P also. He says more than suffering, the most important, you know, the attitude which you need to develop in life is the titiksha, which we all know is the tolerance. And he keeps saying that, you know, the tolerance is one of the highest attitude which needs to be developed so that any kind of suffering, you know, you need to tolerate it and develop this, you know, habit of tolerating all the sufferings which you get out of samsara. So the very fact that you are in samsara itself is that you are suffering. So it depends upon how you are able to tolerate the suffering. And Swami P very beautifully puts it. He says this tolerance is referred in the Bhagavad Gita at three places. One is in the second chapter, which is the Tiksha. 13th chapter, which he says is the Shanti, which is again equivalent to the tolerance. And again, in the 18th chapter, he talks about Shama. So my take is, say, one is, you know, give me suffering. Okay, that is the highest level of, you know, practice where you say, whatever you give, I will take it. But at the other end, we also need to practice, you know, how to mitigate the suffering so that, you know, we understand that what exactly the life is and then come out of the samsara. So that is one which I wanted to, you know, clarify. The second one is, of course, you know, we have this three phases of any, you know, this Vedantic journey. Let's call it, you know, knowledge. First we gain the knowledge, then there is practice, which is the abhyasa. and finally the values. So we have these three outstanding, I would say outstanding verticals. See, develop the knowledge and then do the practice, your abhyasa, and then finally, fine-tune your values. Certain values you may not have, certain values you may have by your birth or your, previous samsaras. So how is that, we give equal importance to all the three, or which is more predominant than the other two? For example, let us take, we have good knowledge and we do good practice, but our values are on the downtrend, like simple values like, helping others, or, trying to be friendly with others, or you are very your words are not very good. So what is that we need to do to balance these three? So which comes first is my question. I mean, it is actually a subject of debate. The knowledge and practice is more important, which is the jnana and the abhyasa, which is again, which you need to do. The jnana and abhyasa is so personal, no? You need to do it by yourself. But values, no? You need to deliver the values. It is more of, what you are going to do to your family, your society, for example, to your own, what to say, country also. So what is that, which is more important is the question. And I think if somebody can clarify this, it would be helpful. No? So I just thought I will roll this out in this satsang so that people can give their views. Thank you.
Hey, Srini, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can.
Yes, we can. We can.
Sorry, I'm having a lot of issues today.
But we can now.
Yeah, on your first statement, yeah, fully agree with that. It's just existence itself is called samsara, right? So depends on attitude and how we respond to things. And I don't think we can really avoid anything as long as the existence is there. So,
should we be delivering these values, deliberately, or, sometimes, you may not feel you have those values. But, like hypocritically, you might be doing those values, just because, you're tending towards Vedanta, you might like to do something, but it could never come from your inner heart. So how to, moderate this, how to develop this, like, is this the entire journey, where we need to correct ourselves, or should we become so good that, because Swami P also was saying, you can't become the best and you can't become the good always. You may need have to moderate in certain places. You may not be good at all places. Certain places you need to be, a little bit, what to say, you need to get angry, or you need to put forth your point, which means that, you can't be, the perfect individual all the time. So that is where I'm coming from. How do we moderate and then, get this done? Because suffering was the topic. I thought, we can discuss also what happens after suffering. And how really, to mitigate this suffering, what to do, and then how do we take it forward?
Obviously.
Srini, yeah, go ahead.
Subbu, sorry, just one quick thing. When you say good, right, at a deeper level, there is no good or bad. It is what we are defining as humans, what is good or bad, and we create moral values, and there is no punyam, papam, all of that really don't exist, right? It is just our creation because of the human existence. We create boundaries and ethics and all of that. So at the end of the day, if you want to think about it that way, then what is, just like you said, what is good for you may not be good for me. And so there is no real definition for good or bad. They I don't think they really exist. But go ahead, Subbu.
So, Srini, my reflections are as follows, right? I think this entire journey of spirituality is from a state of imperfection to seeking perfection. That's how I would see it. Okay. And why this imperfection? I think we have read this number of times, is the three gunas that keep playing the role. Okay. Avidyaya Trigunaya, which is the reason why, you know, people are of different shades. Okay. Thanks to their SRTs, and people are different. And there is no one single person who is 100% perfect at this point in time. I mean, that's the journey that we are all wanting to take. Second thing is, therefore, how does one really work under the circumstances is as follows. Is, you know, I am remembering this nodal theory of, you know, Swami Paramarthananda, that, you know, the human values that you spoke about are definitely important. Satya, Dharma, Shanti, Prema, Ahimsa. Okay. And even what Satya Sai Baba has said is that you follow one, you know, everything else will, you know, follow you, right? It's the noodle theory, right? You start to pick up one and try to follow one very sincerely. The rest of the things will not be far away. Like, for example, if you were to speak truth and you take, I will be, really speaking and following the path of truth, then you're doing dharma. And if you're doing satya and dharma, then you are at peace. You know, you have shanti. Then when you have a peace at this year is when you can start to love yourself and then love others, right? And then you have compassionate towards, you know, other fellow creatures, animals, etc. You have, you know, ahimsa also following. So you start with one, but you continue, you know, and everything else follows. So it's a journey that everyone is taking. Even here, I think in satya, what is said is that speak the truth, don't speak the untruth, and speak truth which is palatable. That is satyam bruvat. Bruyat, priyam bruyat, na bruyat satyam apriyam. Okay, even there are conditions there, right? That is, do not speak truth which is not palatable. Like, for example, you find somebody fat, somebody thin, somebody dark, somebody, you don't have to go and say, you can't say, make mockery of him and say, I'm speaking the truth because, you know, he's fat and stout and short, you know. So, na bruyat satyam apriyam. And it actually, even if you take Adi Shankara's, Prashnota, that Ratnamala Malika, no, he says, there is a question that is asked to him in that particular book. He asks him, when is it okay to actually lie? You know? And he says, his one-line answer to that is to uphold righteousness. That is his one-line answer. And you can see these references in the Gita also, right? Of how Krishna plays the game, right? And how a doctor, even if, you know, he is curing a patient who is actually recovering from cancer, he's not going to tell you that you've got cancer, you're going to die in a few days, right? So he's going to tell you something to encourage you and motivate you to move forward. So that is the only exception to truth. Otherwise, the three principles in following truth is follow the truth, do not speak untruth, speak truth which is palatable, right? So I think this is a journey, and we also know that the gunas are the ones which are holding us back, and one needs to work on that. And at the end of it, we have to finally renounce even the sattva, right? So it's first, you know, rajas is better than tamas, then afterwards sattva is better than rajas and tamas, but then finally you have to renounce sattva also, right? So that is a journey that we are taking. So I think that's how I see it. I mean, so values are important. I don't think you can reach your destinations without values, but everybody is on a journey. So don't beat yourself. I think just take to one thing and stick to one thing. Everything else will follow. Even if you were to take one value and follow it sincerely. That's my take. Yeah.
Superb. The nodal theory was really, really revealing. Yes.
Yeah.
So this is one area where you follow one value, the other values falls in place. Excellent. I think discussion. Thanks.
So if I may add, Subhu, that was really nice. And very similar thoughts. I was about to talk about gunas, but you mentioned it. We are born with certain samskaras, right? We cannot change that. We were born with that from prior number of births. So that is our constitution. That's our nature at this time. Well, when we were born. In this birth, human birth, we have the... It is possible for us to alter that through the course of this life, right? So we were born with certain constitution. We found it in a certain way. In this birth, we can change it and make it better as we exit this body, right? So that's how I, you know, yet another way of looking at purpose of life personally is that we the purpose of life is to make it what we found, make it better and leave it in a better place, because that is the one that's going to go forward to yet another life. So leave it in a better place, because that's only possible in a human birth. So that's, to me, is how I understand purpose of life. Now, everything else kind of falls into that, right? So then what does that mean? How do you do it? And then, so one of them, as you pointed out, and the samskaras are nothing but the proportion of rajas, tamas, rajas, and sattva, right? That determines what your thoughts are, and thoughts, your deed, and what you speak. Everything is driven off of that, right? So, but that is technicality. It's good to understand it. But then the actions that we do, the way we speak, and our choices that we make, that's ours to do today. So then how do you make those decisions? How do you deal with thoughts that seem to come from, you're not asking for those thoughts to come in, but they do come, right? It is, so how do you deal with that, right? So in yoga, then you, yamas and niyamas become the most important foundational part that is so important, right? We typically doesn't get talked about as much. To me, that's the biggest takeaway out of Yoga Sutras is the yamas and niyamas, because it gives a blueprint. As Subbu said, there, if you were to take, like Swami Ji, Guru Parananda would say in his Yoga Sutras, he would say, if you take ahimsa as one value that you decide to uphold, he has the same theory with noodle theory, which is that if you uphold ahimsa, which is at the thought, at the level of deed, at the level of speaking, thought. Speech, as well as thought. Thought is the hardest one, right? If you were to uphold that, then slowly anger would go away, patience would develop, respect, compassion would develop, right? So, and your speech would be appropriate. You wouldn't speak too much. You would, whatever you say, you would want it to be not only appropriate to your point. It's not necessary that you have to speak the truth at all times. There are times when you would, even a lie would be a truth, right? So the understanding of that. So then there is no mental conflict, right? When we say something irresponsibly, there is mental conflict, there's agitation. So by following these things, the end result is that the mind starts to settle down, to be more and more centered and stable, right? We become more sattvic. The choices we make, then there is moderation, right? We are obviously faced with so many different things. How do you just moderate? Is it that, you know, the food we eat, everything, amount of sleep, amount of work we do, there's moderation in all of that, right? So there is a blueprint of how we can go through life such that our mind becomes more and more stable, in centered, purified, and more tranquil. And from that point, it allows us to move forward, right? Allows us to even think along the lines of what Vedanta is asking us to go, right? Yeah, otherwise it's not even possible. That's like the table stakes, right? So yeah, so to me, values are extremely important. There's a book called The Value of Values. I highly recommend that. Swami Dayananda's book, and amazing. I mean, it takes the values from the 20 odd values from Bhagavad Gita. But to me, yamas and niyamas are part of that too. And if you look there, that is the blueprint. The underlying part of that is dharma. And to me, the way I understand dharma, in a very, very simplistic way, obviously it has multiple layers to it, is that is the golden rule, right? You do to others what you do want others to do to you, and you don't do to others what you don't want others to do to you. Basic stuff, right? If you keep that as a basic thing and then build values on top, almost like a pyramid, then you have it. You have the blueprint of life. I mean, everything else then, being able to accept things as they come in, all that is part of it. But then the third, last point, and I'll come out of my soapbox, it's the FIR theory that Swami P keeps saying, frequency, intensity, and recovery time. So, you know, let's say we lose it 8 out of 10 times today, over this time, can we, does it go down to, you know, 6 and 4 out of 10 times and then less? Intensity, how intense do we feel in times of distress, and how quickly are we able to come out of it, right? Recovery time. So he keeps saying that nobody's perfect, but you can measure ourselves. You don't have to tell anyone. It's our own internal measure that we can do, and see how this journey is going to take us there. And over time, the dispassion is going to increase. That so that's going to keep coming up, and that will change things. You're going to change. It's not that you're going to remain the same. Your physical body, your mental, your subtle body is going to change over time, and you'll see that different decisions will be made. You'll see that. That's a journey.
I just have one point, Srini. I think you had made mention saying that, you know, if somebody is asking me for help, am I helping them enough? Right? I think I just wanted to just say one line which Satya Sai Baba used to say, is that even if you cannot help anybody, right? And if you have to refuse them, refuse obligingly. Yeah. So I think there are small steps in which we can put certain things in practice in our lives, which can make a difference in our journey and our movement forward. Yeah. So just to give an example, if somebody is knocking on your door and asking for alms and they're not going away, right? And you know you don't want to sort of encourage that, do not shout at them. Do not make them feel miserable more than what they are already in terms of a state, right? Correct? Do not say something which is more hurting than what they're already suffering right now. So if you want to refuse, refuse obligingly. It is okay. And I follow a principle that if I'm not able to do something, I will chant one Gayatri in the name of that person who's asking for the help whom I'm not able to sort of, you know, give. So just put it on, transfer the burden from your end to, you know, the Lord, right? So just transfer the burden. So he will take care, because he's infinite and he's capable of, you know, taking care of everybody, right? Including you, including him, right? Sometimes what is being said is, you know, the people who come and ask you for these are referred to as Naranarayanas, you know, Narayana in human form coming to take so that he can elevate you in a certain way. Okay. So end of the day, it's a monocosmic play act, right? Where Narayana is seeking from Narayana, you know, something from Narayana. It's like that, you know, it is like, it's a play, one monocosmic play act. So if you can't do anything, just transfer the burden to the Lord.
Yeah, well said, Subbu. But again, the guilt of not helping is always there. So, you know, how do you mitigate the guilt? Because somebody has come to you, okay, he is almost, you know, thinking that you are like a god and he will help, that he will get the help from you. But, you know, like you politely, you say, you know, it is not possible, I cannot do it. But still, that element of guilt lies within you. I think which you said, you know, that we have to bounce it back to the God is what you're trying to say.
See, I'm saying every time the help need not be monetary, right? Mm-hmm. There are other ways by which one can actually provide help and console people. For example, if you just were to listen to somebody out, right, completely with a full heart, you know, that itself would take away half the, you know, the burden that he or he, she is going through. Right? Whether you are in a position to receive and at the same time, you know, be consoling, that itself is good. And there are many ways to sort of, you know, do this. And the only thing that is required here is if you are having enough empathy, at some point in time, you'll know where to, you know, find your balance, right?
Yes, thank you.
I want to comment on what Srinivasan originally asked, and that is, if I understand this right, there's knowledge, there's practice, there's values, and how to spin which is the priority. And I would say, just like we're all a mixture of the three gunas, we're a mixture of those three, and it can change during one's life. I also want to say, in the Gita, in chapter 8, Krishna is basically saying, okay, you can go to Brahmaloka, and you can get the knowledge there that you are Brahman. In chapter 9, the message is, you're already Brahman. Atma is Brahman. Why would you wait? Why would you want to go to Brahmaloka? Okay. So again, you will find I'm a relentless Vedantin, for which I will not apologize. But that being said, in verse 30, which is really one of my favorites in chapter 9, which we'll get to, Swamiji in his Bhagavad Gita home study translates that as, even if someone of highly improper conduct seeks me without a sense of separation, he is to be considered a good person because he is one whose understanding is clear. This is not really a progression. You can, because we always are who we are, we don't really have to get completely purified to get it. It doesn't really work that way. We can't ever be other than who we really are. And what he's saying here is that person, if he knows that he is non-separate from me, everything will get cleaned up. Everything will get worked out. Because coming, knowing that he is all and everyone is him, he's not going to persist in ways that are opposed to the value of values, which, by the way, I think is a lovely treatise and was and is incredibly valuable to me. I think it's really one of Swami Dayananda's most pertinent works, although it's not Vedanta-based, as we've all talked about here. At times, it's hard to hear what is true, but we plod along. And I think much of what's said here is of great value. If you take the noodle theory is beautiful, I totally agree with that. But I also think that relative to the mind, the whole idea of judging ourselves by our actions, by our thoughts, is a misnomer. You can only judge the limited. We are the limitless. What are we doing? Who's doing that? And it's more important, I think, when the mind misbehaves, as all of our minds do. You can do japa, which is a great way of getting the mind to be quiet. And that quietness shows you that you are not those thoughts, because you were there before them, you're there during them, you're there after them. Another great way to deal with a prickly mind is to recognize I am the one who knows the mind. The one who knows the mind is forever free of the mind. If we can recognize awareness in ourselves as that which is always aware, and that awareness is always free, then again, in any moment, we can take true refuge. And I truly believe the more we do it, the more it becomes clear to us that we have no other home.
Excellent. Excellent.
Well said, Rick. Well said.
And thank you. Thank you, Rick.
And just to, I don't know what I can add to this lovely discussion other than trying to bring up two or three stories from Mahabharata that I recently read. And, sometimes Vedanta is a little, quote-unquote, at such a flying at maybe 50,000 feet, but we want it at maybe at 5,000 feet or something. And Mahabharata sometimes helps there. So I'm going to narrate these two or three stories very, very short, in a short way. But I encourage you to read those stories in Mahabharata. So this is in Vanaparva, actually. And this one story, and I think they are related, narrated by, in a similar breath, by the bunch of people. But I can't be 100% sure because there are too many stories and, sometimes it gets jumbled up in my mind. Okay, so the story goes as follows. So there is this guy who's very, very proud of his tapas shakti, okay? He's always in the forest and meditating and all that stuff. And then he sees, one day when he's doing this tapas, two birds, shit on him or something like that. And then he looks up and then he burns them to ashes. And then he's proud, but at the same time, he's hungry now. Now he's going to the village. And now he's going to a place and he knocks the door. He says, I want alms. And that woman, that householder woman, she comes out. She looks at him. She says, okay, wait, I'll bring you some food. And she goes inside. And by the time her husband comes into the home, and when the husband comes into the home, she forgets about this guy who's asking for the alms. And she starts tending to her husband to take care of her husband and all that. And then this guy is so upset. Why are you not, treating me with respect and giving me the food what I want? And then in his mind is thinking, I'm going to, I burnt those two birds. And then that woman comes out at that point of time and she says, now I finished serving my husband and here is a ram. By the way, you know, don't think that, you know, you can burn me off like those, you burn those two birds in the forest, because my dharma is to take care of my husband first. And if I, as long as I'm doing my dharma, I don't care what I'm doing. Okay. So in a sense, she's kind of, you know, subtly telling that person, doesn't matter how much penance what you do, how much tapas what you do, how much, you know, practice what you do, if I were to put in your language, in English, what the words that you use, knowledge, practice, and values. She's saying that I am following what I have to do in my life. And that's foremost for me. I have taken a vow that this is important for me and I'm going to do. And then she tells him, okay, listen, you have not understood what the reality is. And actually the guy who comes and asks for the arms is a small boy, quote unquote, in the age-wise compared to this lady. So he says, you have not understood. You think you have understood, but go to this particular city. There is a guy called Vyadra, I don't remember exactly how to pronounce it. And that means butcher, actually. Go to him and he'll tell you what it is. And then he goes there. And he does not know, she does not tell him that he's a butcher. So he goes there and he asks everybody, you know, where is this person by this name and all that. And they point him out to a shop, okay? And then this guy goes there and he sees that guy chopping meat. And then he asks the guy, okay, you know, I'm looking for this person. He said, that's me. So he's totally aghast. He says, how can I even come and talk to you? How can you tell me what Brahman is all about and all that, all those things? And then he says, listen, you know, I'm just finishing up my job. Let me chop all these things, give it off to the customers. Then we'll go home and we will talk in my home. Then he says, okay, since that woman who had this vision that I had burnt two birds in the forest that only I knew about, since she has recommended me to go and talk to him, maybe there must be something in this. And then he goes with this butcher to his home. And in the home, the butcher is taking care of his parents as if they were two small children, you know, old parents and stuff, and he takes care of them. And then in the whole discourse, he says, listen, you know, at the end of the day, you know, what I'm doing there is what I'm supposed to be doing. But I am not that. Okay. My job is to take care of the parents. And incidentally, you know, I know all this because I know what my real nature is. So what you need to recognize is recognize your true nature. Do whatever you want to do after that. It does not matter. Okay. Whatever value that you want to practice, you practice. Now, in the two cases, you know, we talked about the householder lady practicing the value of putting the priority of her husband on top of everybody else. And in the other case, this guy putting the priority of his parents on everybody else, yet at the same time, doing something, quote unquote, as bad as chopping meat and selling it to people. Okay. But he says it doesn't matter. What you're not, and the guy who comes and asks for the arms, he's a great tapasvi, a practitioner, okay, who's practicing. But that guy had missed the fact that, you know, for what is he doing? Who is his real nature? The knowledge part of it he had completely missed, but he had taken that pride in his tapas, which had to be subdued for him to realize that. So, you know, to Rick's point and to Kishore's and Subbu's point, you know, it's always a mix of all the things. So in the spiritual part, the way that I have understood this is, there is going to be a point of time when you realize that you are not who you think you are. And the world is Brahman, you are Brahman. Yet there is a dissonance. You're not behaving like that. But if you keep that in mind and say that I am Brahman, Aham Brahmasmi, and continue doing what you're doing, then I think that's the right path to take.
See, just to add to this, no, when you said Aham Brahmasmi, etc., I think the challenge in Advaita has been that it is preached, but very difficult to practice. Okay, Advaita is preached and the knowledge is shared, but practicing Advaita and that, you know, in a pluralistic world is the challenge, right? I think, you know, whereas in the Dvaitam philosophy, I mean, it's a comfortable way of, you know, doing this, you know, because you are in a pluralistic world and you surrender. You know, apply Sharanagati and you keep the Lord in your thoughts and you move on. In fact, one of the things, you know, I read recently on the Hamsa Gita is, you know, there is a question that comes out, right, which says that you know, how are we to live in this world when we are, you know, drawn towards so many things? You know, we are drawn towards an object and by the sense organs. And later on, even if the object is not there, the object is sitting in our minds, right? So at one stage, you are drawn to the object. On the other stage, the object is drawn into your mind, okay? So both happens. And how does one get rid of this? You know, how do we unsolve this, or, you know, break this puzzle is the question that was put across. And the answer to this is very similar to what Krishna has been always saying, that he says, trying to unbuckle this or, you know, solve this is not going to be the solution. There is no solution to, you know, remove this. It will continue to happen. And therefore, he says, what is the solution? The solution is think of me. So the moment you leave this and you attach yourself to something superior or the supreme being, then everything else just falls off on the wayside. Okay. And it's just a matter of time. Yeah.
Also, just one comment about Vedanta being difficult. In this chapter 9, which we'll get to, Krishna is saying just the opposite. And it's a good discussion he has, which we should have also. But, you know, you can't unscrew Maya. It is inscrutable. But if you stand beyond Maya, there's nothing to have to unscrew. And I think this is what Krishna talks about in this chapter, which we'll talk about in chapter 9, is if you have vichara, if you analyze what I want in life, and you can determine where it's not, and you can have dispassion about where it's not, without keeping scores, you will naturally be directed, whether it's through knowledge or through bhakti, whatever combination. Really, once you know there's no home in the world, there's no home in Maya, you won't, you know, you can only keep doing it in a sense for so long. Your own choices become clear to you. And the more we embrace what it is we truly value, then what we truly value embraces us.
Nice.
Yes, Guru.
Hey, can you hear me okay now? Okay. Sorry, I wanted to mention one quotation from Value of Values, I think, Swami Dayananda, and we don't have VP with us today, but this used to be his favorite, and we kept discussing it when we met last year, and we did kind of a similar trip that you all did, Uday, went to Thiruvannamalai and gave alum and all that, with myself, VP, Krishna, and Ajay. The value of values, there is a quotation, I believe, which says, a value is a value to you only if the value of the value is valued by you. So I just love that quote. I'm sure Swamiji just rattled it off just out of his, you know, infinite knowledge and everything, but so it's the same thing, but it's just that quote sticks and sticks to your mind, and I keep trying to think of that every time we get into this dilemma, right? The other thing is what Rick, you were mentioning about Maya. So the mind appears separated, but we have to use our minds to interrogate ourselves. So it's like, you know, you're in the fishbowl, but you don't know you are in the fishbowl. So you have to jump out of the fishbowl and then look at the bowl. But then in that instant, you jump back into the bowl again. But that's the reality of it. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
It's a beautiful thing, though. The mind has to keep interrogating itself, which is very intriguing. Sorry, go ahead. That's all I wanted to say, Srini.
Yeah, sorry. Just to add on to what Rajesh was saying now, Kunz. In fact, Swami P, in one of his Shivaratri talks, I don't know whether people have listened to it, he has actually, you know, defined what are the best values in three facets of life. One he calls the general life, the second is the religious life, and finally you have the spiritual life. So in the general life, the three best values, what he's trying to teach us is helping others is the first value, what he's thinking as the biggest values of life, if your general life. The second value, what he says is, of course, ahimsa, don't hurt others through mind, talk, or physically. That is second value. And of course, the third value he says is the titiksha, which means is the tolerance. So on a general living front, these are the three values which you need to cultivate. And I'm very happy to listen from Subbu that once you start one value, it will lead you to the other value. I mean, that is really a revelation to me. And, you have these three values as the overall, overall foundation of your values. The other values will automatically fall in place. The second is the religious journey. What he says is we have the Shraddha, which is the faith. Of course, the Bhakti to Ishvara. And the third value is the Vairagya, which we need to develop. This is on the religious front. And finally, on the spiritual front, he says again, it is the Shraddha. We had Shraddha in the religious phase, Shraddha to your religious scriptures. But here the Shraddha is to the religious knowledge, so which you are going to gain from the scriptures. Here also he says Bhakti. There it is Bhakti to Lord Shiva or the Ishvara. But here it is Bhakti to your Guru, who is going to lead you to the ultimate destination. And there it was Vairagya. And here it is, of course, vichara and inquiry. So, speaking of values, I thought, this will give us a good insight. Excellent. On what are the three values we need to follow on the general, front, on the religious front, and on the spiritual front. So, I thought I should quote this today, which I think I listened to this a couple of days back. And I think it really hit me. And I've made a note of it also. So I think the group will definitely, take it forward and try to support in these three values. Thank you.
Please post it in WhatsApp, because once we are out of this particular session, the 3x3 matrix that you put across will be lost.
Okay, sure. I'll do that. Thank you.
I think, Rajesh, the last five verses of Confucius that you want to just summarize? I mean... I think there are two aspects which came to my mind. One was about the reason for incarnation. There are lots of messages that is being floated around. So I think that answer to me was in Paritranaya Sadhunam and, Sambhavami Yuge Yuge. And I think the last part is about Sharanagati, right? I think she basically, when Krishna is leaving, she says that, you're my savior, et cetera, et cetera. So what about that last part? I thought was more hinting towards Sharanagati. And in between, she talks about the various forms of devotions and how devotees are, constantly thinking of you. That Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu who comes in. I think those are the three reflections in the last five. Yeah.
As a side note, it also struck me that Kunti is using this reference of sandalwood in the Malaya Mountain. Malaya Mountain is the western Ghats of India, where you find the most of the sandalwood trees. Interesting. Very interesting.
And I just was just trying to understand this. King Yadu is Yudhishthira or Yaduraja?
Yadu is Yadava King Vasudeva.
Yadu, okay. No, she says you're born in the clan of Yaduraja, no? Something like that, right?
Yeah, that's the Vasudeva. Vasudeva is the Yadava clan, right? Yadava, Vasudeva.
Yeah, because there's a reference of Yaduraja in Avadhuta Gita. So that's why I'm just asking whether it's the same person that is being referred.
This is clearly talking about the Yadavas and Vrishni clan where Krishna is born.
Okay. No, even the Yaduraja there is the forefather of Krishna there.
Oh, okay. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Good. Hey, yeah.
Srini, the values that you mentioned, I just wanted to add to that. Oh, looks like Srini jumped off. Oh, no, you're here. Okay. I think Kishore, you referred to this several times, and the yamas and niyamas. In the Yoga Sutras, the biggest value that I have seen so far is the ahimsa and this noodle theory, the whole thing, right? And it just picks up all the other things. And apparently that is stressed to a very high extent. So much so that I read this quote from the same Edwin Bryant book, that if you are a yogi, non-vegetarianism is non-negotiable, or vegetarianism is non-negotiable because of the ahimsa. So going back to your first question, right, like what do I know, like how do I make choices, etc. You can make choices, I think, based on that. If you say that I'm a vegetarian because, okay, yeah, I know this is like another can of worms, but I'm because somebody has been harmed somewhere and I do not subscribe to that harm, then that is one way to think of it. So then yogis do not consume non-vegetarian. And there are various levels of this, right? If you look at the Mahavira descendancy, and then they will even clean the pathway that they walk in front of them and all that stuff. So the references to stuff like that, but I think it comes coming back to the basic principle is this value of ahimsa being the foundational aspect of everything else. I thought that was very strongly advocated in the Yoga Sutras.
Because anything that's symbolically, right, like if something is stated as the first, that's usually given higher importance, right? Like, so ahimsa being the first yama, and that's how Swami Guru Parananda talks about in his lectures on Yoga Sutras. So, you know, that's just symbolically, that's how it's been written, right? And I completely agree.
See, actually, just two reflections as you spoke, right, on ahimsa. I think the Chaturmasya Vratam, right, you know, you'll find a lot of the sages, the yogis, the gurus, etc., they normally pitch camp in one place. They don't travel. They stop traveling those 4 months. The only reason is that while there are other things attached to it, one of the reasons is that it's a rainy season here, and the worms and the insects and everything starts to, you know, come out. And in their, you know, reason to do a pilgrimage from one place to another, they should not accidentally also, you know, cause harm to the, you know, insects and worms. So that's one of the reasons why Chaturmasya, all of the, you know, acharyas and the gurus, etc., pitch camp in one place and they do, you know, bhashyams and, you know, discourses, right? That's one. The second thing which I reflected on was on ahimsa is, you know, the one of the persons who's talked about a lot, I think this is a story which actually happened with Paramacharya, right? The sage of Kanchi, when people, you know, where he actually spoke about Prahlada Charitra. And he gave the example of Prahlada for ahimsa, saying that even when, you know, the Hiranyakashipu had sent a lot of people, you know, to, you know, beat up and kill Prahlada, you know, the Sudarshan Chakra comes to save him. And now it's the reverse, like, you know, all of them are running away from it and trying to, you know, move away from the Sudarshan Chakra. And Prahlada is at that point in time actually praying to Lord Vishnu and said, do not kill these people, you know, do not harm these people. Let the Sudarshan Chakra not harm. And that is the maturity, the spiritual maturity of a maybe a less than 10-year-old child, right? Correct? And the only reason is, he says, is that, you know, one, not to harm anybody. Second is that they're only, you know, taking on the instructions of my father, who's the king, right? And I think that is a very exalted, you know, topic in Prahlada Charitra, where Prahlada prays to, you know, save and not hurt even his enemies. Okay, so from that example and point of view.
I think more than the physical level of ahimsa, I think the stress is more on the mental level of ahimsa. So because,
both, no?
The intent and what's on the thought level and so on. I think that's where most of us would fail, you know, because this vegetarianism and all, yes, like for example, the choice I'm a vegetarian, but you can always extend that to even plants and all, right?
It's the extent. It is the extent. That's how we can think about it.
But you're right when you say, sorry, go ahead. I'm just saying, I think Sakuba, you're right that when you say that ahimsa has to be practiced, I think everything that needs to be done is thought, word, and action, all three. Yeah.
Yeah. A contrasting thing that came to mind
to this Prahlad story, I just wanted to add, which I thought was kind of funny, and I was listening to, this is a while back, I listened to Swamiji's lecture, and Yama meets Nachiketa, right? The Kathopanishad. And the way it starts is Nachiketa starts observing, and this kid is also like really young. He's less than 10 years or something. He starts observing his father, who's doing a big yagam, and he's donating all these cows to his people. And apparently he gives the weakest cows. He starts donating the weakest cows. So Nachiketa is like, why are you doing this? You're giving the weakest of your lot and you keep for yourself the strongest things. And he just calls him out there. So his dad gets, you know, pardon my French, but his dad gets really PO'd, and he says, I'm going to ask Yama to come and take you, or you need to go away or something. He banishes him. So that's how the whole thing starts. So that just came to mind when you were talking about Prahlad praying for everyone. And this kid went to his dad and said, you are not doing this right. Which is really cool. But the thing is, Nachiketa goes to Yama and then later on says, don't do stuff to my father. You know, don't kill him or something. Which is also really interesting.
In fact, I didn't give you the context of when this was discussed with Paramacharya. I think I'll just tell you the context. I mean, I've told you what the answer was. But there was a foreigner who actually went to Paramacharya and asked him that, what is the thing that I should practice as a human being and be eligible to be called a human being? Okay. You know, and how do I live my life in such a way that I can lead a good human life? And this was asked to Paramacharya, and his response was, he said, why did you come to me in the first place? Right. So the discussion goes on, and he says, no, I went to all the seers and, you know, sages, not just of your faith, but of every other faith, but I wasn't too convinced with the answer. Right. And then Paramacharya asked the pundits there to come up with a, you know, a solution and an answer. He says, you guys are the Vedic scholars here, so why don't you just tell him what the answer to this question is? Right. And finally, they all got together and they said, no, with Paramacharya around, I think it's better that you speak and you say. And then when he was given the chance to speak, he cited the Prahlada Charitra, and he says, if you really have to live a human life, you know, you should not be causing harm to others, right? And then he cites the Prahlada Charitra. So this was the entire context in which this Prahlada Charitra and not to harm others is being quoted. And to, you know, sort of link it up with what Kishore said, right? The value of values, the first value that is spoken about is to first be a human being. I, you know, last time I had spoken, right, in Satya Sai Baba also, when he said he's giving a guru upadesa, so he called everybody and he said, he first say you're not an animal. Okay, that was the guru upadesa that he had given. Then he said, first say that you're not an animal, then you say you're a human, and then you say you're God. So I think the stepping stone is to for a human being is to, you know, practice ahimsa. I think just to tie it up.
And about ahimsa, we also have to say it begins at home. Do no harm to yourself. Don't judge yourself. Don't beat yourself up.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. See, all this can only happen. You can transfer love and happiness to other people only when you're at peace and, you know, in love and happiness with yourself, right? If you're in contradiction with yourself, you can never pass on peace and, you know, love to others, right? For you to be able to, you know, deliver that, you have to be in peace with yourself first. I think well said, Rick. Yeah.
Awesome. 7:31, and I think umbrella of Kunti Stuti, I think we sort of covered a little bit more than what Kunti Stuti is. So I'm not disappointed that we did not do enough justice to Kunti Stuti. I'm perfectly fine with it. So next satsang, we will complete the rest of the Kunti Stuti, and we will take up chapter 9. But before we do the chapter 9, I think Krishna wanted 45 minutes of on a topic called "Where Am I?" Not "Who am I?" or "What am I?" Where am I? That's a pretty interesting topic. And then I think I also requested 45 minutes to sort of summarize the symbolism in Durga Saptashati. And so we'll finish that, and then we'll get to chapter 9.
Rajesh, just one question. I think, do you have something else where you have read Kunti Stuti in terms of a commentary or something? Because we have one, but is there anything more?
It's only on Srila Prabhupada's books. But then I saw that Muku, you posted about Nochur's talk yesterday in Tamil. But though in Tamil, you might want to check that thing out.
I also checked out a Tamil thing. It went on for 2 hours, but 41.5 hours is all about bhakti. You know, the half an hour is about Kunti Stuti, and they finished fast.
Yeah. So I've listened to a couple of very beautiful lectures in about Kunti Stuti in Telugu, and all of them pretty much basically summarize in a very similar fashion like what we are talking about here, saying that okay, it's a mix of Vedanta plus bhakti,
yeah.
And then they kind of take a diversion to sort of give the context to the people, saying that who was Kunti, why was she doing this stuti, and what was the calamities that she was going into, and then trying to send across the message saying that, okay, listen, at any point of time, whatever calamities that you might get into, think about Kunti, because she was thinking about God all the time. Therefore, if you lean on him, then those things are temporary, they will just go away. That's the kind of message what everybody is sharing.
Thank you.
All right, we'll conclude. Sarve bhavantu sukhinaha, sarve santu niramayaha, sarve bhadrani pasyantu, ma kaschid dukkha bhaga bhavet. Om shanti shanti shanti. Shri Gurubhyo namaha. Harihi Om. All right, everyone.
Thank you.
Hari Om.
Hari Om. Hari Om.
Thank you.
Hari Om.
Thank you.